The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
It's a coal crisis in India. The power minister warning that the country's energy crunch could drag on for another half a year. Coal accounts for about 70% of India's electricity generation, and a slump in local coal output has meant those stockpiles are dangerously low.
What's driving this? It is structural underinvestment in the ability to supply and deliver these commodities, particularly hydrocarbons in the face of decarbonization. Put simply, poor returns in the old economy saw capital redirected to the new economy, choking off the capital needed to grow that supply base. Then you overlay ESG issues on top of that, you create this very significant structural impediment into supply.
Tesla is moving its headquarters from Silicon Valley to Austin, Texas, where it is building a massive car and battery complex. Chief Executive Elon Musk announced the plans on Thursday at the company's annual shareholder meeting. Texas is known for its cheap labor market and less stringent regulation. Oracle, HP, and Toyota Motor have also moved their headquarters from California to Texas.
The Swedish Health Agency on Wednesday said the country is suspending the use of Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine for people born in 1991 and later. That announcement came after reports of possible rare side effects among youths and young adults, such as myocarditis, an inflammation of the heart muscle, which the Mayo Clinic says can include symptoms that resemble a heart attack.
A Facebook whistleblower has told US lawmakers that she believes Facebook's products harm children, stoke division, and weaken democracy. Frances Haugen has been telling a Senate hearing that Facebook's leaders know how to make their products safer, but won't, because they've put their astronomical profits before people.
It is about Facebook choosing to grow at all costs, becoming an almost trillion-dollar company by buying its profits with our safety.
A global push to establish a minimum corporate tax rate is one step closer to reality. The deal is set to be finalized at an OECD meeting today after key holdouts, including Ireland and Estonia, agreed to the terms. The framework establishes a global minimum tax rate of 15%.
I think it's going to be a challenging quarter, this fourth quarter, and maybe into the first quarter of next year. I think inflation is going to run a lot hotter than what the Fed thinks. We see prices going up everywhere. And I think there's going to be pressure on the Fed, not only to start the taper, they're going to announce that, but to taper faster than what the market thinks.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stocks saw a bit of chop this week, but ended up higher on Friday after Congress reached a two-month agreement on the debt ceiling until they'll be forced to revisit it again in December. Headlines proclaiming that a debt default crisis has been averted, at least until the holidays. Hi everyone, I'm Chris Sheridan, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. With inflation numbers continuing to remain elevated and much more persistent or non-transitory than the Fed has been expecting, Financial Sense's Frank Barbera joins us today to give us an update on his outlook and says gold is reaching oversold levels just as stagflationary pressures continue to rise. Also in today's show, we are going to play an FS Insider interview from last month with a guest who predicted the global recession last year and also forecasted that inflation would continue to increase well ahead of all the headlines that we are seeing and reading today. Her name is Dr. Nada Sanders, and she is a global supply chain expert. So if you aren't a subscriber to our premium weekday podcast, definitely encourage you to listen to this very important interview, since as we have been discussing on our show, this is one major blind spot for the Fed when it comes to the outlook for inflation and how things are likely to unfold in the weeks and months ahead. But first, Ryan Poplava joins us to give us this week's market wrap.
The equity indices staged a rally this week with the S&P 500 up 0.8% to kick off a better monthly start to October than September had. A lot of that had to do with the oversold conditions that set up a buyable rally when Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell gave some investors relief that the U.S. wouldn't go into default later in the month. In addition to that news on Wednesday, it was announced that President Biden and Chinese President Xi would hold a virtual summit to discuss trade later in the year. That sense of relief filled buyers with some confidence to buy the dip on Wednesday and into Thursday. A bill did pass the Senate Thursday to extend the debt ceiling until December 3rd by an additional $480 billion. So those 2 days of rally accounted for 3.3% of gain in the S&P 500 from the low to the intraday high. One of the major catalysts behind the correction in U.S. stocks over the past month isn't just the debt ceiling. It's been energy inflation and the specter of a change in monetary policy with talk around plans to taper the Fed's asset purchase program. There's also continued discussion from companies about labor shortages, supply chain disruptions due to COVID, and raw material shortages that have been ongoing, such as with semiconductors. Despite the rally we got this week on the debt ceiling relief, those other problems haven't gone away. Given inflation has been stickier than originally anticipated by the Fed and the market, and because the cost of energy has been on the rise, interest rates have been rising for long-term treasuries just as they did in the first quarter of this year. 2 months ago, the 10-year treasury hit a low of 1.12%. A month later, 1.3%. And as of Friday's close this week, after a mixed jobs report, closed at 1.6%. The change in interest rate curve, so the steepening, has been helping financials with long-term yields rising and short-term yields well anchored by the Fed and expectations of the Fed willing to raise interest rates pretty far out right now, I think about another year. But on the flip side, it's hurting yield-sensitive areas like utilities, real estate, and staples. Additionally, high-growth stocks and technology stocks have also lost a lot of performance here. And in the time span we've seen rates rise over the past 2 months, West Texas Intermediate crude has reversed from a low of $62 a barrel in August to just tap above $80 intraday on Friday. Natural gas in the U.S. has gone from $3.84 to $5.57 recently. And according to the Wall Street Journal on Wednesday, global production of coal, which generates around 40% of the world's electricity, is down 5% below pre-pandemic levels. And the price has quadrupled in the past year. So if growth stocks and bulls are still concerned about inflation, there's been no relief there. And that may be why buyers faded stocks on Friday after that mixed jobs report. Private sector payrolls increased 317,000, with the unemployment rate down to 4.8% versus 5.2% in August. So a nice change down there. Average hourly earnings increased 0.6% over last month. And that represents about a 4.6% year-over-year gain in average hourly earnings. Of course, that's great if we want consumers to be feeling wealthier, to be able to buy more things come holiday season. But that, too, also is an issue for companies' profitability. Given the numbers weren't incredibly strong, there's still some debate over whether the Fed will announce a taper later this month. But the inflationary pressures we're seeing may see the Fed finally move regardless. 8 of the 11 S&P sectors closed up this week, with energy up 5% and financials up 2.3%, leading the gains in the sectors. Real estate down 0.8%, healthcare down 0.3%, and communication services down 0.1% were the three sectors that closed down this week. Chris, back to you with our very own Financial Sense portfolio manager and technician, Frank Barbera.
This week, Louis Goff spoke with FS Insider to discuss his thoughts on China, Evergrande, energy shortages, and how he believes we are moving into an extended age of shortages and what that means for investors. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week.
In an age of plenty, you buy things that are nice to have, video streaming services, social media, and whatever else. As you move into an age of shortages, you want to buy things that you need to have rather than things that are nice to have. So you buy things like energy, like food, like autos. And so I think this shift is now just starting in the market. And that's going to be the big theme for the coming years, shifting portfolios from things that are nice to have towards things that you need to have.
To listen to this full 40-minute interview with esteemed strategist and investor Louis Goff, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times.
Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us as this week's market technician is Financial Sense's Frank Barbera. Frank, let's start with your overall macro outlook as far as the major drivers for investor sentiment today. We've got a number of different things that I know we can discuss: inflation, global supply chain issues, an energy crisis, and of course, your technical take on the stock market. But let's start with your overall macro outlook.
One of the points that Chris Poplava has been making is that inflation would likely be sticky, and also that interest rates are rising for the wrong reasons. And I think he's right on the money when it comes to that. When you look at typical cycle, when you have expanding growth and growth is getting better, you know, there might be some pickup inflation along with that growth, and interest rates can rise. So you see growth expanding and interest rates rising. That's interest rates rising for a good reason. What we see right now is altogether the opposite. We see growth is definitely slowing. Arguably, it could be slowing sharply. So we are seeing a lot of, as price inflation has been moving up, and we have seen just about a week ago, the core PCE deflator, which is the Fed's favorite inflation gauge, rose to 6% year over year. That's eye-popping. That's a gauge which is, it's, you know, mathematically constructed in a way where it's not that easy to move up. And it's the highest level since 1983. So inflation is surprising to the upside. Some of the other measures of inflation, like the shadow government statistics, John Williams gauge is 13.5% thereabouts. So inflation is clearly picking up a lot of velocity, depending on how you want to look at it. And just as clearly as prices are moving up, this is hitting consumer confidence, as we've seen forward surveys of buying a new appliance, buying a new car, buying a new home. These are plunging across 40-year ranges, and it implies that there is a slowdown taking place. So I think one of the things that is maybe the most fascinating part of this is this concept that the Fed has put out about the idea that inflation is transitory. And I think to that end, you know, while it's certainly, you know, you have to give them some sympathy because this has been a tricky period to navigate. There's been a pandemic. The pandemic threw a lot of things off with the supply chain. But when you really look at it, right now, for example, in LA, the port has 66 ships backed up. I've been near the port of LA for 40 years, so I know kind of what it looks like normally. I've never seen anything like this. There's container ships scattered all over the LA basin. And what has happened in recent years is that if you look at the world's largest container ship companies, most of them are related to China, and there's sort of an oligopoly. And right now, China is going through an energy crisis with coal. They're having a hard time getting enough coal, and so their manufacturing plants are not running at full capacity. So there are fewer sailings taking place along the Pacific routes. And that means that inbound cargo is dropping off significantly. And we are seeing day rates for container shipping at lease levels that have never been seen before. So when you sort of look at the situation, around the world, there are energy shortages in Europe with natural gas, in London, empty gas stations. There's sort of each one has its own root cause, but in most cases, there seems to be a tractable issue behind it, an underlying cause that has staying power. And so when you really sum it up, it doesn't look like any of this is going to go away altogether that quickly. And I think the inflation is not as, quote, transitory as one would have thought. To me, it seems like this inflation is going to stay high well into the first quarter of next year. And that means that the Fed could be very far behind the eight ball in terms of not only not tapering, but also in terms of raising interest rates. So it's a kind of an interesting scenario, because if they are behind the eight ball, they may end up having to tighten rates a lot more aggressively next year. And that could play a lot of havoc with the capital markets.
Yeah, it's interesting. I played a clip from Jeremy Siegel. He just this week, I believe it was on CNBC, warned that, you know, we are seeing inflationary pressures rise across the board on almost every single good. And we are going to see a CPI print next week. That'll be the official CPI number. On the last print, a lot of people were surprised that it was as low as it was, even though it was higher than expected. They still expect it to be a lot higher because notably absent from that headline number was the impact that we're seeing from rising rental rates, right? The largest component of the CPI measure is owner's equivalent rent. And that was notably absent. It didn't show up. So now the thinking is we're going to see that show up in this report, unless there's something weird going on with the data or the manipulations of it. You know, who knows? But we should expect to see that show up next week, because rental rates by some measures are up, you know, 10% year over year, if not higher, which do lag home prices. And home prices, as you and most of our listeners know, are up at the highest rates we've ever seen on record. So what are you expecting for next week in terms of inflation numbers or potential market impacts?
Well, I think in terms of inflation numbers, I think inflation numbers are going to stay high. I think you're going to continue to see weak data. Right now, higher prices are doing what high prices very often do. They are slowing the economy down. Now, when you take that situation, and let's say you add on tax hikes, which are in the not too distant future, let's say you add on another big stimulus bill that could come, and that would spur inflation even more. If the Fed lets too much time go by and they finally raise interest rates, one wonders how the stock market will react. The stock market has been addicted to quantitative easing to the nth degree. And so when that is finally removed from the picture and there's a tapering that begins with, then you could have a falling stock market, which would be a negative wealth effect. So you'd have rising taxes, big deficits, falling stock market, and embedded inflation. The Fed may actually be missing their window to move interest rates up. And if the financial markets do roll over at some point, they would actually have to do what? They would have to do more easing. They would have to cut interest rates, and they would be cutting interest rates from a starting point of zero. So this is a little bit like the Kobayashi Maru scenario that was at the beginning of Star Trek, The Wrath of Khan, where it was a no-win scenario. You know, almost whatever you do, something is going to come out the other side that's going to be rough. So I think we're kind of moving. The Fed is facing a little bit of that Kobayashi Maru outcome. And by waiting to taper and by waiting to tighten rates, I think they're risking a bigger problem maybe later on. So, I mean, we'll always have to see. But right now, I sense that gold has moved down and is getting very oversold. So we're seeing the yellow metal begin to, it looks like it's put in a big double bottom and a smaller base forming over the last few weeks. And I'm beginning to think that money is beginning to flow into gold because it's getting nervous about, you know, just hedging policy risk. And I think there's a high policy risk error in here. Money is looking at the inflation that's basically affecting the average family to the tune of like $2,000 a year in extra costs. And I think some money is going to start to pile in towards gold. So to me, I think that's something to watch for very carefully. You know, keep an eye on the gold price. It's hovering in the mid 1760 area right now. And 1830 to 1840 is really the key overhead resistance. If we see gold moving up through 1830 to 1840, I think that's probably a signal that it's beginning a much more protracted advance, an advance that could be durable, not only just for a couple of months, but an advance that could last longer than that and easily carry the metal to new highs. So to me, I think watching the precious metals, this is that point in the cycle where the inflation is really picking up, it's becoming problematic. And the fact that the Fed has been holding back so long, rightly or wrongly, at this point, I think the money is starting to look for an alternative hedge. Some would say, well, maybe that's going to be crypto this time. I'm old school, and I think that ultimately the precious metals are tried and true, and they will always come through in the end. And so so that has my attention fully right now.
Well, I want to go back to what you said earlier. You explained how interest rates are rising for the wrong reason, not because of economic growth, which is currently decelerating, but because of inflation. And as you warned earlier this year, investors really need to be thinking and preparing for a stagflationary environment. And I would say certainly within the last month or two, the financial media has been running with that word, as we have seen, you know, economic growth undershoot while inflation has been running on the high side. So it does look like, you know, stagflation is here. And perhaps that's something that is going to be carrying with us into 2022.
Chris, when you look at a lot of the elements, the shipping container side of it, fewer sailings, you can look at the energy side of it, where crude oil inventories are very low. Crude oil looks like it wants to move a lot higher. And so, I mean, I could see crude oil moving to triple digits in the weeks and months ahead. That's very scary. That's, as Jim used to say, when crude oil is moving up, that's like the equivalent in the old days of the Fed tightening the Fed funds rate, because the tightening the Fed funds rate is stepping on the brake of the economy. It restricts credit. But when crude oil and gasoline, which is closely related to crude oil, when those are moving up, that's having the same net effect. It's hitting consumers in the wallet. It's causing them to have their basic needs be more expensive, so it cuts back on discretionary spending elsewhere. And so it's very regressive to economic growth. And I think that we are heading into this stagflationary period. It's tough right now to figure out exactly how and when we get out of it. It's a little bit of a dark hole to look through.
Yeah. And when we think about here in the US, I mean, we're talking about stagflation here, but imagine you're in Europe, or imagine you're in even India and China, where they're having to cut power and they're seeing massive, massive surges in their electricity bills because of the energy crunch that they're facing. So, I mean, we really don't have it that bad, but I will admit, you know, what are you paying for gas where you're at? I'm paying for about $4.25, sometimes $4.50, depending on the week. What about for you?
Closer to five ten, five easy.
Yeah.
More often. So it's expensive in LA, and I think there's just a lot of taxes. But you know, from an investment point of view, you want something. You want an asset that is going to be a tangible asset as a protection against inflation. And I know there are big adherents to cryptocurrency. And for those people who feel they understand it, comfortable with it, I say, God bless you. It's a little ephemeral to me. I have a hard time, you know, fully appreciating it. I also feel like to some degree, it's something that's easy to regulate. Gold, however you want to, you know, say good or bad about gold, but gold has stood the test of time for millennia as an asset that's not simultaneously someone else's liability. Gold has been a very good hedge on a very long-term basis against inflation. And so when inflation is moving up, it tends to, you know, in the 1970s, you saw interest rates moving dramatically higher, and the gold price was moving right up, right along with them. The interest rates were actually lagging the inflation rate. And that's also certainly the case right now. You know, you have 5% inflation and 0% essentially short-term interest rates. So you really have a minus 5% real yield. You have a 1.34% 10-year bond yield, which minus 5% inflation is a minus, you know, 3 and change. So you have negative real yields. That is an environment that is conducive to gold. And I think that's where we're getting close to. The gold mining stocks are actually cheap and leveraged relative to gold. So I look at them right now. I've been watching them 35 years, and I think this is one of the great buying opportunities in history in the gold mining stocks. I think they're very cheap valuations, and the upside potential versus the downside risk, they're down about 37% over the last year, August to August, you know, a little bit more into about a 14-month bear market, 37%. You know, this feels like a good time to look at inflation protection, at least in my opinion.
Let's talk about gold here for a moment. You know, I've got a little bit of some gold mining stocks in my portfolio, and they haven't been performing nearly as good as I would have hoped, but a lot of people say on the contrary side that, you know, gold's not going to do well. One is because interest rates are expected to rise. As you noted, during this late 70s, we saw interest rates skyrocket higher, and that didn't derail the gold bull market then. And that was, again, a stagflationary environment like we see brewing today. The other thing is the U.S. dollar, however. The dollar has been stronger than I think a lot of people expected, especially given the fact that we're just spending money like drunken sailors. A lot of people would have thought that the dollar would have been weaker, but it's held up. So, you know, what is your view on the dollar and how that relates to your outlook on gold?
My suggestion at the moment is for folks to pretend that the dollar index does not exist. And I say that because if you look at the dollar index for like the last 30 years, it's been in a broad range. It's been fluctuating against the euro and the yen. And I know that there's something of an inverse correlation between the dollar and the gold price. Okay, so that's sort of a given. But when you adjust the dollar index divided by CPI, which is the inflation, right? You are seeing the dollar index actually going down. It's a steady downtrend over 30 years, not horizontal movement. It's declining. And this is what you sense and feel. You kind of intuitively know this is right when you go into the store and you take out $100 at the supermarket counter and you look at what you can buy. A couple of years ago, you could buy a lot more with $100 than you buy right now. And I think that has become noticeable for more and more people over the last year. Same with the gas tank, right? Just doesn't go as far. And so inflation is chiseling away at the purchasing power of the dollar. And if you're not getting a commensurate interest rate on the money that you have in the dollar, then you're losing purchasing power. Now, gold has been going down over the last 12 months, so that hasn't been exactly wonderful, but gold does that. It has these swings up and down. And what I've been very careful about, I've been very careful with it. When it was trying to move up into June, I was not really that convinced that it was a good. In fact, most of my indicators went to sell signal in mid-June. And I'm very glad they did, because we missed most of this decline. But I see exactly the opposite of that now. I see very high puts to calls readings, very high ARMS index readings. For those who don't know, the ARMS index is a measurement of, it looks at advancing and declining issues. And I use it in the gold stocks. I track a universe of 30 gold stocks. How many are up each day? How many are down each day? What amount of up volume and down volume is taking place across the group? And when there's been a lot of down volume taking place on the stocks that are going down versus buying pressure or up volume on the stocks that are going up, when that condition has prevailed for a very long time, you get these very high ARMS index readings. And that tells you there's high levels of fear. And in markets, usually to make money, you want to be buying the fear. I know it's contrary to human nature. We tend to want to run away when we're scared. But in markets, you need to, it's contrary opinion. And when, as soon as downside momentum ebbs and you start to see the early signs of an upside reversal, those are the three components. First, you need fear. Then you need to see dissipating downside momentum. And then you need to see upside reversal. Well, we have two out of three right now. We have massive fear in gold stocks. We are definitely seeing downside momentum ebb. This positive divergence is showing up and base building activity taking place on the charts. And now the last little piece is upside confirmation through some positive price action. I think if we see that, again, the metal moving really from 1760 up through 1780, that'd be the first little sign, and then clearing 1830 to 1840, that'd be a big, big, fat green light. GDX, which is around the 30 and a half area, that taking out 31 and a half on the upside. Not a recommendation here, but just an observation. There's a declining trend line for a couple of months that comes right around 31 and a half. There's also a very cool moving average, which is a 24-12 displaced moving average, which is right about the same level. So if GDX gets through that resistance, that's a pretty big green light. And so, you know, no prediction. It's just a question of what you want to do is be attentive and watch. Active daily watch and monitoring is what's going to carry the day in this environment. And by being attentive to it, as you see it start to improve, you want to be responding and say, okay, if I don't have any of this in my portfolio, maybe this is a good time to be adding in some inflation protection. Some of the stocks that are out there, wheat and precious metals, and again, I'm not recommending this, I'm just using it as an example, and Agnico Eagle, which are in the mining space. I have a gauge called selling intensity that tracks selling pressure. They recently, both of those stocks came up to almost all-time record highs in selling intensity within the last week. And that is not always, nothing's perfect, but it's often a pretty good leading indicator for a turn for the good. And it tends to be the case when you look back in history, you find that these big spikes in selling intensity are often correlated with important lows. So sometimes it's always a lot easier to see after the fact, but it takes a lot of bravery when you're looking at something volatile and trying to buy it. But one way to go is just to nibble at it. You know, you buy a little on one day, you wait a while, you look for some weakness, you buy a little. Spacing out the buys is a great way of working your way into a market like gold and keeping your nerves under control at the same time. And that's always important when it comes to investing.
So Frank, you're bullish on gold. You think we're close to a buying opportunity. It sounds like you haven't gotten a confirmed buy signal given the indicators that you look at. But again, I mean, investors should be using drawdowns as opportunities to scale in if that's a sector that they're interested in hedging into.
Scaling in is exactly the perfect phrase, Chris. I'm glad you said that. I couldn't have said it any better myself.
Now, what about the broad stock market? This Monday, we did see a bottom around 4280 on the S&P 500. And you know, we have seen a rally since then, a little bit of softness on the day that you and I are speaking on Friday, but overall stocks were higher for the week. So what do you see on the stock market side of things? And let's focus on the S&P 500, if you will.
Well, you know, to me, it looks like it made an important short-term bottom earlier this week in that low 4,300, high 4,200 area. I think the S&P is going to come up and make another new high. I think the resistance is up around 4,610 over the next few weeks. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see the S&P make a new high. But I believe it or not, I think for the rest of the year, we're really going to end up in a trading range. So if we do get to 4,600, I wouldn't be surprised to see another sell-off for a period of a few weeks, carrying it back down to the mid-4,300 area, and then another rally up across the range towards the high end of the range, and then another sell-off. There's something called a symmetrical triangle. And symmetrical triangles are five wave patterns, the A, B, C, D, and E. And I think that's what we're going to see unfold over the next 3 to 4 months. And I think we just did the first leg, the A leg down of that. And now we're in the B leg up, which will carry up to around the high 4,500, low 4,600 area. And then a C leg down towards 4,350. And then maybe back up to 4,500 and back down to 4,350. It's a consolidation pattern where price is between 4,400 and 4,500. Probably that's going to be about the middle of the range. And then if all goes well, it should come out topside post that consolidation pattern and have another run. And that run could run it up to 5,000 sometime next year. I think at that point, we'd have to see exactly what's going on with the inflation and what's happening with Fed tapering, because the market is at very high valuations. It's at record high valuations. And when you have monetary tightening taking place against the backdrop of extended prices and high valuations, that can be a recipe for stock market trouble down the line. I don't think we're getting there now. I think this is a next year issue. It may even be a second half of next year issue. The second half of next year, there's a 20-year cycle low in 2022. And before that, bottomed in 2002. Before that, bottomed in 1982. You can just kind of go back. That goes back over 100 years. So second half weakness next year makes sense to me. And I think that's got something to do with when the Fed actually finally has to start tightening rates aggressively to deal with inflation. So I think the party is still in one piece in the stock market. You do have to watch it. If we move below 4250, I'd get a whole lot more nervous on the S&P. But as long as we're holding above 4250, I think the path of least resistance is sideways to higher, and things will, you know, kind of roll along for a while longer. But at the same time, I also think markets that have taken a big breather and that are sort of fresh and ready to go, maybe like the gold market, that's maybe an area for where prices are kind of relatively low rather than relatively high. That may be an area where you can find some value.
Okay, so if I got things correctly, when it comes to, let's say, the S&P 500, you think we did see an important short-term low this week. And at this point, it looks like we may be seeing a rally continue until the end of this year. I do want to note that one of the reasons given for the rally this week was because, you know, obviously Congress lawmakers were able to make some type of agreement on postponing the debt ceiling, kicking the can down to December. So that's now given us at least a couple months.
Out to December 3rd, exactly.
Yeah. So, but the problem with that is they're going to have a number of other things that they're going to have to be dealing with all around that same time, not the least of which could also be, like you said, Fed tapering at that point, depending on, you know, what the Fed is going to be announcing, expected to announce shortly, if not in November. So lots of interesting headwinds coming up towards the end of the year.
Yep. No, it's a time to be very attentive and watchful. And because this has been an extended and very long run, it probably still has some ways to go. But, you know, right now, the background factors are getting more and more intense, and they need more and more scrutiny. So we'll just keep a close eye on it and continue to ride the wave as much as we can.
Well, Frank, as we close today's interview, anything that we didn't get to that you'd like to discuss with our audience?
No, I think we were really good. Chris, I hope you have a great weekend, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Last year, one of the world's largest tech companies, Microsoft, made a multi-billion-dollar investment into creating one of the world's largest supercomputers for the exclusive purpose of training and commercializing the most advanced and sophisticated artificial intelligence currently in existence, called GPT-3. If you haven't read some of the news and controversy surrounding GPT-3, it has gained a lot of attention since its release by a company co-founded by Elon Musk due to its ability to not only perform a wide range of tasks, but also because of how lifelike it is. Our guest on FS Insider this week is Mikhail Morin, who posted a video that is now stirring a lot of debate on the ethics of this technology, especially when we think about just how advanced deep fake tech is nowadays. Here's a clip of what he told listeners this week on FS Insider.
We're at very early stages in this development, and I do this for a living. I follow trends, and I can tell you that with all likelihood that within the next few years, that will be mainstream. Having automated news presenters, automated assistants, web assistants, or, you know, you call a hotline and you think you're talking to a person, it could just be a more advanced GPT-3 model running through a system like Synthesia, who's talking to you. So we're closing in on artificial general intelligence.
To listen to this extended conversation with Mikhai on GPT-3, how he created the videos that are stirring a lot of controversy currently, and more, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Joining us on the show today is Dr. Nada Sanders. She's an internationally recognized thought leader and forecaster when it comes to the global supply chain and supply chain management. She's also the author of numerous books, the most recent of which came out last year, titled Humachine, Humankind, Machines, and the Future of Enterprise. Dr. Sanders, thank you for joining us again today.
Thank you for having me.
So as I pointed out when we spoke with you in the past, we first had you on the show in February of 2020. The S&P 500 was hitting a new all-time record high, and you had forecasted that we were likely to see a global recession to hit that year in light of what we were seeing with COVID, the disruption to the global supply chain, especially since China was the epicenter of all of this. This was well ahead of consensus. Most people were not thinking of a global recession at the time. And we saw that obviously take place. And then when we spoke with you earlier this year, in 2021, you had said that because of what we're seeing with global supply chain and how long it takes for it to heal and recover, especially in light of the ongoing outbreaks that we are seeing, that against the Fed and consensus economic opinion, inflation was very likely to remain persistent and not transitory, as everyone had been saying, especially at the Fed. And as you know, that is exactly what we've seen. Inflation has remained higher, the Fed admitting to that now in their most recent statement. So if you wouldn't mind, let's start there. Give us an update. Do you see much of an improvement at this point, or are things still problematic from a global supply chain perspective?
I'm sort of chuckling a little bit at the word transitory, right? Because at the end, isn't everything transitory, right? And so when the Fed had said that, well, you know, it is transitory, I remember thinking and sort of chuckling to myself, well, they can always say it was just a matter of years, if you will, tongue in cheek here. But, you know, it is going to be with us for a while. The reason for that is the same as what we had discussed last time, but I think it is more dire, and I can elaborate on that. Supply chains in general take a really long time to rebalance after an event. And historically, supply chain disruption is just part of global supply chains. It will take a little bit of time and then they come back. But what's happening now is we're having one hit after another into, you know, what is really a very weakened global supply chain system. And it's kind of like taking a sick person and then continuing to, you know, expose them to various illnesses. They really can't come back. We are now going into, we're in autumn, pretty much. We are not too far from the holiday season. And when we look at historically in terms of what happens to kind of ramping up, at the same time, we have talked for a while about global shortages. We've talked about the chip shortage, what the impact is going to be. We just saw GM saying, right, they're going to be closing facilities because they don't have enough chips to continue production for now. My forecast is that this inflationary period is going to be with us for quite some time. It is going to get worse before it gets better. And I think we're really looking at 23, in my opinion, before things improve. And I'm really sorry to have to say that, but I think that is the reality of it. At each point, we have a different, a little bit of a different view as we see what is going on with this global pandemic. And we sort of see this really massive domino effect, right? Because we see manufacturing production facilities being impacted. But as I talk to companies, and as we see the numbers that are the government
statistics coming out, it is really labor shortages right now that are impacting so much, whether we're looking at transportation, trucking, retail, service sector, across the board, we're seeing labor issues among other problems. So when you begin to kind of couple all of these together, when we look at the system, the global and then the countries, supply chain system or network, it is naive to think that this could possibly come back and rebound in the next month or so. What does that mean? I think it really means, again, we are looking at a protracted inflationary period. We're going to look at continued and exacerbated shortages of goods. We're going to see higher prices. We're going to see longer lead times for the things that we order in everything from the cars to furniture, appliances, and even food items. We're going to see not only higher prices and longer lead times, but a much narrower assortment. I think as consumers pre-pandemic, we were really used to short lead times, really relatively good prices, if you will. The consumer had gotten used to this, you know, global supply chain system working very, very well. And also wide assortment. When I say assortment, I'm talking about choices in terms of products. That's not going to be possible moving forward in this new environment to also offer a really wide assortment. Again, whether we're talking about furniture or whether we're talking about appliances or whether we're talking about cars. So I think, you know, then we're approaching the holidays. I think we should be prepared to see a broad swath of shortages across a variety of goods and an inflationary period. And I think it is kind of a humbling period for consumers. And, you know, in many ways, Chris, I feel like as humanity that we're just sort of reacting and we're continuing to react and kind of scramble without being able to look at a more complex, longer horizon and to be able to prepare well. And it's a little frustrating from my end at this point, because, you know, you and I talked, as you had mentioned at the onset, February 2020. It seems really like another century almost, doesn't it?
It does.
Doesn't it? And so we look now where we are. We saw the vaccines come out. We were all excited. And there was really so much optimism. And I think at the same time, pent up consumer demand, which, by the way, is still there. Consumers are hungry. People are tired. They are tired of lockdowns. They're tired of COVID. You know, everywhere I go, I see fatigue. I talk to colleagues across the globe. I talk to, you know, people wherever I can. In employers, people are tired. However, global supply chains are just struggling. And it's going to continue and it's going to impact us. And, you know, we see this, what's happening with the Delta variant, obviously, when we're talking about the U.S., we see the impact in the southern states. But the discussion is that we're going to see it then more in the northern states. And we sort of seem to ignore the other variants that are on the horizon of COVID, and what is that going to mean, and how is it going to play out? And at minimum, it's going to be a bumpy ride in terms of approaching the flu season. I think it's naive to think that it's going to be smooth sailing within a month or so.
Yeah, I would certainly agree. And again, you know, as you said on our show earlier this year, you thought that given the global supply chains and how pervasive the disruptions have been, that this would mean inflation is likely to remain higher than normal, longer than what people anticipate. That's certainly been the case. And lo and behold, in reference to your remarks about the consumer and some of the fatigue that we're seeing, we've now seen two major consumer sentiment surveys come out. Both of them report well under what economists expected. So consumers are now citing inflation as a major concern, and for one reason why they're pulling back on their purchases or their expected purchases as we head into the heaviest buying season of the year, which is the holiday season. coming up, which has really kicked off, we should say, with Black Friday in November. So from Black Friday moving forward, that's going to be a key time in which a lot of these companies, large retailers, they get in the black. And that's a problem. So I think this is one thing that people really need to be aware of some of the risks that we could be looking as we head into later this year.
Yes, yes. And I think that there is the inflationary concern, but it is extremely justified. And from where I sit and what I know about how global supply chains work, it is really difficult for me to say that it's unreasonable, that it's going to be short-lived. I don't think that that's the case. I think that all indicators point to the fact that it's going to be protracted. I unfortunately think that we are going to continue to see COVID numbers continue to spike. And I fear that we are going to see some of these other variants that are, you know, slowly revealing themselves. But that is going to impact all of us. It's going to impact us, our ability to be able to move about as freely as we have liked. But then when you look at the whole global picture, again, comes full circle into labor, manufacturing, movement of goods, and that impacts ability to deliver everything from toys to appliances. I mean, the housing market, everything. So I think that we are going into a little bit of a dark holiday season. And I think that we all need to be prepared. My advice to consumers is exactly that, what you had said. I would proceed with caution. I think that people have to be very, very careful right now in terms of what is going on economically. And the big question mark in terms of, you know, what the future is going to look like and I think that the degree of uncertainty is relatively high. And I think that when we look at, you know, with regard to COVID, you know, will we all come out of this? Yes, we will. And I think I'm very optimistic in the long run in terms of our ability to be able to have COVID vaccines that will be effective against any of the variants that we may encounter. And from what we hear, from what we understand, COVID is most likely going to become endemic like the flu is. And what that means is that very likely we will end up having to get vaccines on a regular basis as we do with the flu. And there will be a new normal, a new cadence in terms of what our life looks like. But I think as a society, we're not there yet. We haven't really accepted what this is going to look like, and we still really don't know, right? So at the very beginning, you know, when you and I had talked the very first time, I think we were all kind of shell-shocked in terms of what was going on. We certainly had no idea what the horizon would look like. And we saw all these massive shortages of everything from hand sanitizer and toilet paper, and we saw global shutdowns and all of it. Then we kind of seemed to come out of that. But now we are fatigued, we are tired, we want some semblance of normalcy back. But unfortunately, that's not happening. You know, so I think it is still going to be a really challenging holiday season. You know, one of the things too, I've been talking regularly and doing surveys of companies, employers. And one of the things that I just observed is that prior to COVID, there was this sort of heavy reliance on algorithms and forecasting, on analytics. Post-COVID, I actually just completed one survey just last week. The companies that I've talked to are actually relying on their human experts, on their people, on their upper level managers to say, hey, what's the future going to hold? And I remember last year at Thanksgiving, companies overriding their algorithms in order to determine, you know, how many grocery store items to have in stock, trying to predict what consumers were going to look like or do for the holidays, for Thanksgiving. And last year, I remember Thanksgiving 2020, the idea was that most people would be having Thanksgiving at home. And it really changed the assortment and what groceries were offering. And I remember that vividly. I think it's going to play out somewhat in a similar fashion this year. I think companies are going to continue having to do a little bit of override of their algorithms in terms of forecasting. Companies do need to stay afloat, and we need companies to stay afloat, all of us. At the same time, consumers do have to be really careful and watch their pocketbooks now, because even though we're all excited and we want to get out there and continue to be out there, we're approaching a colder season here in the northern hemisphere. And again, the flu and colds and other kinds of things coming on board. And then when you couple that with the whole issue of masking and new variants coming out, it's a really, really challenging period. And again, I think when it comes to products, we are going to need to expect to pay more, probably buying fewer things and paying more for what we do end up getting, from everything, from food items to clothing to appliances. And our assortment, our choices, we're going to have to make compromises. And I think that it's going to not be until really 23, until we have maybe early, you know, end of 22, but certainly not before next summer, before we can actually kind of have some kind of a sense of what the future is going to hold. And I think as we look again, as we approach the autumn, and then winter, I think we are looking at a protracted inflationary period. And then hopefully by next summer, coming out of it. And I only say that with the caveat and the hope that we don't have a variant of COVID that evades the vaccine, where we then are put in a position where we have to wait for a vaccine to, a new version of the vaccine to come out and go through this whole cycle all over again. And what's going to happen if that is the case? What I've been able to track very closely with the pharma sector, with the vaccine development, the companies right now, the way it looks, they within, you know, a 90-day period should be able to come out with a version of the vaccine. But then again, we're going through the whole cycle of having to vaccinate everybody, and of course, what that would mean for consumer confidence, the consumer spending, all of it. Again. Looking at a very weary consumer sector, it could be problematic. So provided that that does not happen, that we just continue on this course, then I think by next summer, things will start to come back. I don't think before that, Chris.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I want to share with you a personal anecdote that it was interesting along these lines of both inflation and just supply disruptions. I had ordered an item during summer that I was hoping to have to try to help on the amount of heat coming through. It was actually just a patio umbrella. And I ended up ordering it through HomeDepot.com. It was an online item that I had ordered. I expected it to become, they had said, within about a week or two, which was perfectly fine because summer was going to be persisting for quite some time after that. It kept getting pushed off and delayed and delayed and delayed. Lo and behold, 2-3 months later, still had not gotten it. I asked for a refund. Thankfully, they gave me a refund. But then, you know, I had to cancel the order, tried to go to Home Depot to get whatever they had in stock there, and they didn't even have anything that was available in the store. So I just said, you know what, I'm scrapping that. I'm going to go with something completely different. And I mean, this is the experience of most Americans right now. And obviously, again, bringing this back to what we should expect during holiday shopping season, you're going to see a big ramp up in demand. Supplies are not going to ramp up automatically. This is not something that is just all of a sudden, you know, the global supply chain is going to be able to produce all these goods to meet demand. I'm sure many retailers are trying to gear up, but it's just not there. And I want to share some data points here. If you look at the most recent data of inventories to sales, it is at an all-time record low for as long as data's been collected on this. So there's essentially, for the amount of sales, inventories are at a record low level. So that's one thing to keep in mind as we head into holiday shopping season. Domestic auto inventories, all-time record low as far as the data's been collected. And I don't know about you, Dr. Sanders, but when I drive by the car dealerships where I live, there's hardly any cars in the parking lots. It's amazing. I mean, you would expect them to be full. Hardly any cars there because they aren't able to make the cars that they need because they don't have the chips that go into the cars. It's phenomenal.
How many times do we hear, you know, GM saying, oh, we're going to close down, shut down the plants, and we'll work on these other vehicles in the meantime. We'll get everything else ready until more chips come in. So, you know, one of the things, and actually, if you're talking about cars, I did see the statistics in August, the average vehicle in the United States, the average car was $41,000. I mean, the number that is a staggering number when we look at what the price of cars is now. The other thing that you had mentioned, which is it's a very important ratio, inventory to sales. And you're right, I did see that. It is record levels. This is typically the time when retailers are really stocking up their inventory. This is typically the time when that inventory to sales ratio is actually really high, September, October, as we begin to approach, historically at least, building up towards the holiday season. The fact that we are starting the holiday season, we're going into, you know, if you can, you know, call, you know, Halloween, I mean, that whole autumn, holiday season, the fact that we are starting so low is scary. It's frightening. Because there simply isn't enough inventory. There aren't enough goods. So what happens in a case like this? What's going to happen is the retailers, the companies that have the best contracts with their suppliers that can afford to pay the most will, you know, you basically have competition. And scarcity of goods. The goods for the final consumer are going to be extremely expensive and really short supply. And that's going to get exacerbated as we go into fall because we're starting out really lean right now. Supply chains right now simply are not going to be able to respond. I know in the, you know, retail, particularly if we look at toys, and I mentioned toys because they're such a popular item, obviously, during the holiday season. That lead time typically is many months that you would actually begin to start to stock up inventories of toys at retailers. And it is extremely lean right now. So it's not only the one data point or cross section in time, but it's also that trend line. So what we see where that trend line is moving, in addition to the cross section in time, I think no question leads to the fact that we're looking at this protracted period. The other thing too is that it takes a really long time. You know, one of the issues that we're talking about is the shortage of semiconductors or chips. And first of all, there are many different kinds of chips. But also to create facilities to manufacture these chips, as we're seeing companies try to do here in the U.S. now, realizing that we're in trouble. We have a major problem that we need to create domestic production of certain critical items, and chips is certainly one of them. It is going to take a few years to get to that point. That's really what the issue is. One cannot just put up a factory in a matter of months for something that requires such high technical expertise, materials, technical skills of labor, and so forth. So it is going to take, I know Intel is working in this area, number of other companies, and they're looking at, you know, if we're going to have domestic production, we're looking at 23. And so it's going to take a few years to get to that point. And I think in the meantime, again, I can just hope that by next summer, things somewhat stabilize. But that's just going to be somewhat stability. Supply chains, I think if there's a single disruption, we say typically on the average, a 3-month rule for things to come back. This would have been a single event, the Suez Canal that would have been when we had the ship lodged in the Suez Canal. You know, these kinds of events happen all the time. It's just part of global supply chains. The deep freeze in Texas that happened last February that created shortages of, you know, chicken, variety of poultry, variety of items, foam that goes into, you know, furniture, cushions, a variety of things. But we're having one after the other after the other. And I think just when we thought we were coming out of it, seeing, you know, having the issues with the Delta variant that is impacting, you know, global transport and global manufacture. But one of the issues that is overlaying on top of that, all the usual things that we would see, you know, how a supply chain would come back, the issue of labor. And the reason that is such an important part is that now we're dealing with humans, human emotions, human reassessment. I recently read somebody had said, you know, you take a machine and you shut it off, and then you can turn it back on. But a human reassesses, rethinks, you know, reimagines and recalibrates, but also rethinks. And I think that's what we're really seeing. We're seeing workers saying, what is it worth to me? What is my existence worth? What is my life worth? We're seeing so many issues with regard to childcare, with regard to a variety of different kinds of costs that labor is one of the biggest impediments right now across industry sectors. And that's something that's not easily revamped, replaced, ramped up, because you're dealing with emotions and issues of confidence and satisfaction that are really hard to measure. And so when you overlay that on top of physical assets like chips and so forth, you're, I think, adding to the complexity of these supply chains and really trying to think of solutions that are going to be much broader, that I think are most companies just simply are still really stuck in a very old way of doing things. I'm seeing executives on the one hand, many of them saying, we really need to think about talent, how we treat talent, how we recruit talent, the kind of packages we're offering. Then we're seeing CEOs who are saying, got to get back to work. That's it. If you don't like it, leave. It's going to be really interesting which model plays out, how it plays out, and how labor shortages, labor skills ramp back up, if you will, with our supply of the physical items. Chris, you had just, you know, a few minutes ago shared the story of your inability to get an item. The issue is that everybody that I talk to is having the same kinds of issues. Items that they're ordering, whatever those items are, garden equipment, furniture, they're finding massive delays or having to compromise on what they're getting and really having to pay a lot. And that is just simply going to continue. It's going to, I think, for the duration, require a reset of consumers to get ready for these expectations, that it's going to be like that. It's going to be a humbling experience, I think, for everybody that we're not really used to. So it's going to be, I think, unfortunately, a challenging time.
So, Dr. Sanders, in summary of what we've discussed today, you know, looking at the global supply chain and how COVID has impacted it, as you admitted, you know, it can adapt to isolated random shocks, which we see all the time. But this is a protracted failure to the point where it is having cascading effects. And we're seeing this on a systemic basis in terms of workers, labor shortage, goods as well, transportation, you know, some companies shifting to shipping things by air versus by sea, which is more expensive. So there's a number of things that are all lining up here. And this was and is a huge blind spot when it comes to the Fed and economic consensus around the outlook for inflation. A lot of their models do not incorporate the global supply chain into their inflationary outlook. You know, we've discussed the Phillips curve and how outdated that has become when it comes to modeling inflation. And so you've been giving the correct and most accurate forecast so far when it comes to, 2020 predicting a global recession, saying that inflation would likely persist and remain higher than longer, not be transitory again. And so now, given what you're seeing from your perch, it sounds like you believe that we are going to see inflation still remain high, could even get worse before it gets better. This is going to weigh on economic growth, at least heading into next year, especially when we think about lack of supplies being available, higher inflation for many goods that we're going to be purchasing in the coming months for holiday season. So it sounds like you might be lining up for this more and more talk about a stagflationary environment for next year. Would you say that that's accurate?
Yes. I really think it is. But what I wanted to add to what I was saying earlier, because I did not want to sound completely pessimistic, and there is certainly pessimism in what I'm saying. On my end, there's also frustration because I don't feel like we're not learning the lessons. And I'm a professor, and one of the key things is that we're always learning. And the fact is that we're not, and it's frustrating. We have to start looking at the global supply chain as a system. It's an economic ecosystem. And rather, we have historically and have continued to look at logistics. I can't tell you how many times, Chris, people will say, oh, you do supply chain management, you do logistics. And that is such a tiny, tiny, tiny part of it. This morning, I went here at the university. I went to get, we're required to get our weekly COVID tests. And I went this morning, I stood in line, and I could see the way the information flow, the way the different stations worked, people lined up. And I wanted to take a picture. I chose not to because of privacy, but I thought, I want to post this and say, this is a supply chain. And you have people as the product, if you will, in this case. You have information, you have movement. So we need to look at the you know, on a global scale, or we have to broaden what supply chain management is. And we have to understand that it's the movement of not only products, but the movement of information, of money, of people, of everything. And they all work together. And what we've done is we have consistently looked at a very short horizon and continued to operate in silos. So the Fed might just look at economic indicators and say, hey, this is what kind of what we saw in the past. This is what the future is going to look like, without failing to really understand global supply chains and to understand how they work, and failing to understand that they all have components that work together, that come together, and that the context of all of this needs to be understood. I think that it's an opportunity at the same time for companies that are willing to ideate, to think differently. Old school strategic planning, I think, is not going to work. Looking at historical data, as the Fed has done, is not going to work because the horizon is just different. We're in a different, we're in a different universe in many ways. But I think companies that are willing to take their experienced and best people and find different ways to ideate. This is where somebody called a futurist could really work very well in a company to come in and to help them envision a future. I think these companies can take advantage of the fact that consumers want something. They're tired. They want an opportunity to express themselves, to purchase items. And I think companies that can create an offering in a very creative way can do very well.
most companies that I talk to are not there yet. They keep looking at the past and saying, what does the data say about, you know, from the past? How can we, you know, use that for the future, without really thinking that it's a really different world that we're, you know, moving into, and how can we take advantage of this? I think there will be companies that will take advantage of it. I am a real optimist when it comes to human ingenuity. One thing that I am optimistic about is the creativity of businesses, no question, startups, and being able to take advantage of this landscape. At the same time, I think it is an opportunity to also value human expertise. We had gone into pre-COVID really in tremendous admiration of AI. And I believe I had talked a little bit about this at some point in February 2020. You know, pre-COVID, businesses were all about, you know, we have to digitize, and, you know, data and AI, machine learning, all absolutely necessary. But I think we really need to come back now and value human expertise as well, and find ways to integrate human expertise to be able to forecast better, but then all at the same time also be able to take advantage of human needs that historical data simply cannot exploit. Companies that are able to do that will do very well, even though we are going into a protracted inflationary period.
Well, I want to give a big amen to that, and then also repeat that a lot of these topics you brought up and discussed in depth in your book, The Human Machine. I have it right here on my desk in front of me, Humankind, Machines, and the Future of Enterprise, which you co-authored along with John Wood. Excellent book, and you delved into so many topics that I think are just so interesting, especially on along the lines of, as you said, balancing the human expertise with the machine, with the algorithm, with big data, with AI. There is such an important balance there. And obviously, certain environments, certain sectors are going to weight that balance differently. Many things which you get into in your book. So if any of you have not read that yet, I would highly encourage you to do so. Again, it's titled The Hue Machine, and you can find that at any bookstore or, as most people do, order it on Amazon. Well, Dr. Sanders, it was a pleasure to have you on our show again. And again, just speaking to the value of human expertise, you have provided invaluable insights to our audience again and again. And we very much look forward to speaking with you on our show again.
Thank you, Chris. Stay well.
So once again, that was Dr. Nada Sanders. She's an internationally recognized thought leader, forecaster on the global supply chain and supply chain management. She's the author of numerous books, and the one that I just, of course, plugged there, titled Hue Machine, Humankind, Machines, and the Future of Enterprise, which was released last year in 2020. So as she said, she believes that the inflationary period we're facing now is likely to persist, which is what we've been saying here on our show as well. It might even get worse before it gets better. And she doesn't think we're going to be looking at 2023, so for another 2 years here, before things reach some level of normalcy. And that's in terms of global supply chain, the ability to supply the necessary amount of goods to bring inflation back down, at least to something that we would expect to be a long-term trend. Then again, it sounds like she, along with us, believe that inflation is likely to be higher than average going forward. One thing that we have discussed on our show for why that is if you look at housing prices alone, if we're talking here about the U.S., but housing prices globally as well, if you look at housing prices and how that relates to rental rates, owner's equivalent rent in particular is what it's referred to for the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. Owner's equivalent rent is one of the largest, if not the largest, component for inflation. As home prices go up and continue to trend higher, as they've been, we're at all-time record highs at almost 20% nationwide year-over-year increase in home prices. That is a significant tailwind for higher inflation on rent. And so rental rates are likely to continue moving up higher. There's a lag relationship between home prices and rental rates. So that is the major component for CPI. Owner's equivalent rent is likely to going to be increasing going forward the remainder of this year and likely into 2022. So that means the official CPI number should be higher, and we should expect overall inflation to be higher than average. This has significant impacts on a number of things, not the least of which, as we discussed today, is consumer confidence. We've now seen two consumer sentiment surveys come out that were well below economists' expectations. And one of the big reasons for that is the price shock that a lot of us are seeing when we go to purchase something. There's just not enough supplies, and so prices are higher. So consumers are pulling back. Since 70% of the U.S. economy is driven by consumers and consumer spending, that means we're likely looking at a slowdown and a deceleration in the economy for 2022. That's what the leading economic indicators are lining up for. And I think we're going to get a big taste of that this holiday spending season. So lots of things that we're going to be discussing as we move towards Black Friday in a couple months, and especially with the data that we're going to be tracking closely here for various retailers and consumer spending into the holiday spending season. If you have any questions about what we discussed today with Dr. Sanders, feel free to visit us at financialsense.com and hit where it says contact us to leave us a message. You can always give us a call as well at 888, that's 888-486-3939. If you want to speak with any of our wealth advisors about our services, whether that's financial planning or asset management, we have a full team here at Financial Sense Wealth Management who can help you and assist you on any questions or needs that you may have. For FS Insider, I'm Chris Sheridan. Thanks for listening.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.